Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. A new single volume of history sets out to explore the experiment in government that is the United States of America. Award-winning Harvard historian Jill Lepore, author of These Truths, A History of the United States, looks to explore how we now understand the role of women and people of color in our political heritage, and how to put today's politics of division in proportion. The American experiment rests on three ideas, these truths, Jefferson called them, political equality, natural rights, and the sovereignty of the people. And it rests, too, on a fearless dedication to inquiry, according to Lepore, because self-government depends on it. But has the nation and democracy itself delivered on that promise? The new book is These Truths, A History of the United States. It is a pleasure to welcome Jill Lepore to this week's book show. Jill, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
It seems like a monumental task to write a history of the United States. What led you to say, okay, I want to take on this very shaggy history and put it into one volume?
Well, I wish there were such a book for a long time. Just partly for teaching purposes, I wish I could say to, you know, student who comes to college from Australia is like, I really want to take your class, but I don't have a baseline knowledge. You know, sort of wish there was such a book. And it struck me as kind of symptomatic of some of the problems with our partisanship that we have no, they're just people don't write these sweeping single volume histories of the United States anymore. It used to be done all the time until the kind of shattering of, you know, the so-called consensus of American politics in the 1960s. There's been incredible scholarship the last half century about all kinds of people and all kinds of moments and movements, and it kind of just really hasn't made its way into a grand narrative. So I thought it would be, okay, audacious, yes, but worth a try.
Is it in any way, does it come as a result of the election?
No, because surprisingly, you can't write a 900-page book
in 2 years.
In December of 2016 and have it come out. No, it doesn't. And in fact, you know, a lot of the book comes from teaching that I've done over the years, just teaching, you know, U.S. History Survey classes. I teach a course at the Harvard Law School on the history of evidence. There's a lot of stuff in this book about the history of how we know what we know. That's one of the reasons the book's called These Truths. These are matters that, believe it or not, you know, were of concern and interest to scholars before the so-called decline of truth, the year of truthiness, the post-truth society that we're in now. People have been paying attention to this from within the academy, I think, for a long time.
And we'll get to the impact the election does have on the book itself in a few moments. But let us talk about these truths. You begin there. You talk about this in the introduction. Thomas Jefferson called them these truths. So give us a sense of what we're playing with here and then how that is the building block to what you explore.
So I wanted to recover, for one, the Enlightenment spirit of inquiry and empiricism on which the nation is founded, right? That it is a commonplace to say the United States, Chuck referred to the American experiment. But we, I don't think, pause long enough over that phrase. It really, the United States really was meant as a political experiment to test the idea of whether people can erect a form of government that can be just, in which people are equals under the law. That it has always been understood as an experiment at the time. And I think we lose a little by not dedicating ourselves to the principles of that experiment. And it is important to reckon with the ways in which the nation has not lived up to those founding ideals. And even at the time it was founded, was not living up to those ideals. But it is nevertheless, I think, important to cherish those ideals. And that's the sort of line that the book tries to walk, right? Between, like, a lot of books about American history are just kind of American triumphalism and American greatness, and then there's another kind of body of work that's like America's American atrocity and American slaughter and horror. I wanted to bring those, both of those stories are part of the American past, but I wanted to understand the relationship between those two parts of American history.
What I found fascinating is that this does not tell us the story of just the incredible progress that we have made over 200 plus years. It's very subtle and it's quite dark in its progression as we progress as a nation.
Yeah, and even the very idea of progress has changed in the history of the country. I mean, progress used to be a religious idea. It was the journey from sin to salvation, right? That's like the pilgrim's progress. the founders were relying on a kind of more Enlightenment notion of progress that involved the improvement of a republic through the exertion of its citizenry with an aim toward moral progress and the public well-being of everyone. Progress in the 19th century came to mean economic growth and prosperity. In the 20th century, really, in a lot of ways, has been narrowed to technological progress without any concern whatsoever for the idea of good, of goodness. It's kind of disruptive innovation. This kind of cant of our Silicon Valley moment is the idea of progress stripped from the idea of goodness. I spend a lot of time thinking about what progress even means over the course of American history and how it changes, because whichever way you measure it, it's not going to go all in one direction.
Also, as you look, and you going to the very beginning of Christopher Columbus, of that when we talk about truth, we are talking about there is a manipulation of that truth. And you remind us of just where we were at the very beginning and in telling the story and how that story is told and what the truth is.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the book, although narratively, starts in 1492 kind of to call our attention to Columbus's claims and to call our attention to the asymmetry of the historical record. The book really begins with Magna Carta in 1215, because before Magna Carta, people in criminal trials in Europe and in England, you ask God to decide if someone was guilty or not. You'd have a trial by combat, and God would basically determine the winner. You'd have a trial by ordeal, and God would, you know, reveal the guilt or innocence of the accused. And in 1215, with Magna Carta, England chose trial by jury to replace trial by ordeal, which was prohibited by the Pope that year. Trial by jury is really the basis of our whole conception of truth today. In that, in a trial by jury, two sides present evidence and an argument, and a jury decides which side has the better evidence and the better argument based on that evidence. That's how historically, you know, we are told to know what's true. That idea, that notion that there's a trial of facts, moved from the law to journalism to science, it's ubiquitous in our culture. And yet our ability to undertake that trial of facts, on which the founding of the United States rests, you know, Jefferson says in the Declaration of Independence, let facts be submitted to a candid world. That is to say, anyone who reads the Declaration and reads its facts is supposed to be able to decide, hey, do the United States really have the right to declare itself independent based on these facts? That's the whole idea. So the trouble we're in now, the present pickle is, you know, can we still do that?
One of the things that's fascinating in the book, and you do it consistently throughout the book, is you find these minor characters, people in our history that are often unknown. They're often heroic in their actions to help with your arguments and ultimately tell us a story that maybe we thought we knew, but obviously add a lot more to it. Give us a sense not only of some of these characters, but also how ultimately you found them.
Yeah. So what I was trying to do, you know, on the one hand, we have this kind of old style great man political history where it's just kind of the march of the presidents. And then on the other hand, you know, in recent decades, with the rise of social history and women's history or ethnic studies, African-American studies, we have these histories of many more people, especially groups of people, not necessarily even represented as characters, but as groups with interests, kind of an interest group history that comes out of social history. And then what happens with those two ways of doing things is you don't actually get to know people who belong to those groups because they can't kind of compete on the page with presidents in terms of their importance and their influence. Right? Like you got Woodrow Wilson on the one hand, and you got some, you know, immigrant worker who dies in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory on the other hand. You don't know her name or know anything about her. She has left no records behind, no diary. She didn't know how to read or write. Like it's just not, you don't have like and like. I thought about that a lot when I decided to undertake the project. Like, how would I reconcile that? Because ordinary lives matter, and ordinary lives actually do shape history. So how to make that manifest on the page without having these giants overwhelm the people, you know, huge political power. And I spent a lot of time thinking about this with a book I wrote a few years ago called Book of Ages. That's a biography of Benjamin Franklin's sister, Jane. And the whole trick, that whole book, you know, they were like twins. They were like basically the same person, male and female. But she married at 15 and had 12 children, and they all died before she did, and had this life of not from rags to riches, but of rags to rags. The whole trick, the whole book was, how do I convince the reader that her life matters? as against his. You know, think about the claim of Black Lives Matter, just rhetorically, like those lives matter. But if we don't have names and faces and stories and characters and quotes, what do we do with that? So I just decided I would, and, you know, really pushed by my editor, that I would really work hard to find. You don't need a whole lot of people to do this kind of work on the page. You need to have people that can be fully realized. And so, you know, a person I had never heard of before working on this book was this Black abolitionist named Maria Stewart, who was the first woman in the United States to speak before a mixed audience of women and men. She was eventually prevented from speaking before mixed audiences. She wrote these incredible essays and delivered these really very powerful addresses calling for abolition, and was part of a generation of Black abolitionists who did this incredible work of insisting that the kind of narrow idea of political equality that Jefferson had described in the Declaration of Independence was in fact a Christian idea, and it was a bigger idea, and it was about the equality of all people, men and women, before God. And that this is a kind of much more radical notion of equality that she insisted upon, that all Black, white, men, women, all were equal in the eyes of her God, and therefore all were equal under that Declaration of Independence, really kind of sacralizing and realizing the promise of the Declaration of Independence. You'd never know anything about Maria Stewart except for the few of her speeches that survive, except that her husband fought in the War of 1812 and died, and she applied for a pension. And in order to get the pension, she needed a character witness, who had to be a white person. And William Lloyd Garrison, the white abolitionist who founded The Liberator, the abolitionist magazine newspaper, wrote a little character assessment. He described the first day she came to the office as The Liberator and said, "I'd like you to publish an essay of mine," and how imperious and brilliant and impressive this young woman was. And it just, that survives in the National Archives because pension records are federal documents. Like, she's applying for a pension from the federal government. So, you know, just that kind of closely observed what someone would have to say, like in a letter of recommendation kind of thing. That's the only way she gets that third, you know, dimension as a character. I think she does a lot of work on the page. She occupies a lot of space alongside, say, Andrew Jackson.
Jill Lepore is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new book is These Truths, A History of the United States. Of course, in writing this history, you write a lot about slavery. You write a lot about injustice, racial injustice, and this overall idea that so often the truths that Thomas Jefferson wrote about are certainly limited to very few people. And we see this throughout our history. Why was it so important for you to make that point? And what we learn, at least in this book, is how obvious that was at the time.
Yeah, I think in the 1990s, when the kind of big boom of founders' books were published, like everybody was reading the new biography of George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, and there's a lot of kind of book publishing energy around celebrating the founding fathers, that when historians would say, well, you know, it's important to read about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, but, you know, let's think also about slavery. And then the biographers often would say, but, you know, that's judging them by our standards. You know, that's not fair to them. So let's not think about slavery. But when you actually read the evidence, everybody was thinking about slavery and everybody was calling them, you know, a lot of people were calling them to task for it. I mean, I was really struck. Thing that really stuck with me, because I find James Madison completely fascinating and quite inspiring as a really interesting thinker, obviously, the guy, you know, the father of the Constitution. And yet, in the 1780s, after he stopped serving in Congress and was going to go home from Philadelphia, he had a slave with him, a guy named Billy. He called him Billy. And Pennsylvania had just abolished slavery, and you couldn't sell a man. Madison, he writes these letters home to his father, and he says, "I don't know. I don't really know what to do with Billy, because I'd really like to sell him, but that's illegal here. But I really can't bring him home to Virginia because he's tasted freedom, and everybody on the plantation will leave if I bring him home." And he explains that you can be free if you can just get to Pennsylvania. This is the guy who then is going to write the Constitution just a few years later. This is not someone who's not been thinking about the morality or immorality of slavery. This is someone who's thinking about it every day and wrestling with it every day and understanding his own moral compromises. Or, you know, you look at Washington and, this, you know, his desire to free his slaves before his death, maybe even with his inauguration, there are rumors that he contemplated not taking the office of president unless he freed his slaves because he knew that would set a precedent. In the end, he decides to free his slaves in his will, thinking that, knowing that that will set a precedent. It's not historians who are challenging these people to live up to our ideals. These people were struggling with these questions themselves.
In that struggle, it ultimately brings the question that seems inevitable, which is, will it always be a struggle?
There isn't a time that it hasn't been. I think we move on to new struggles. I think we find sometimes that we move on to new struggles prematurely and haven't really shored up gains in older struggles. I struggled in this book myself, speaking of struggle. This is a minor struggle, but I struggled with trying to guide a reader to a place of hope in the current moment, the current political moment, because of the nature of the divisions in our politics, and in particular, because of the way I think it's very difficult to overcome those divisions or to build political bridges, because our partisanship, unlike any partisanship in the history of the country, is automated. I mean, it is really done by machine at this point. It's very difficult to escape the machine. That's not the same as, like, should people struggle, like hashtag resistance or something, or, you know, the other side of that. That's actually the question of how can people improve our political culture.
When you look at that improvement of how much it is on us, how much do you believe as a historian that it is important for us to know the history and to know where we were to ultimately help us to get wherever it is we're going?
Well, I guess I would put it to people who really cherish the founding and the founders and think of, you know, people who belong to the Tea Party and people who really kind of celebrate the nation's heritage, that the founders only did what they did or only were able to do what they did because of their study of history. They're all devoted students of history. They considered the past so many experiments that the historical record was a series of experiments that was foundational to how they understood change over time. That's why they designed their republic the way they did. It was because of a study of the past. So we, I think, undoubtedly are at a crisis in the history of the republic where I would suggest probably structural changes, something more than little tinkering is necessary. And how can we even begin to do that without having a sense of the past? Tragically, we really have less of a sense of the past than at any other time in American history, because we are in this tweet-by-tweet present, you know, where the past vanishes, you know, second by second. There's really just very little hold on things that happened even 2 months ago. I think most people have a sense of that the past, it's not that it's receded, it's that it's kind of scrunched up in this tiny shrinking thing that trails behind you instead of this long banner that waves blocks and blocks and blocks past you.
In this history and in our long history, where has leadership shown that it of what it can provide us and what a lack of leadership can unfortunately allow us?
I think Lincoln is the best example of what leadership can do. Lincoln was a man, I think, of considerable courage. He's not some infallible god of a kind of Greek hero, but he made a real commitment to speaking with a certain nobility of purpose on behalf of the nation itself, on behalf of the American people. And that's why he endures, but I think we miss the point if we don't understand how much that mattered at the time, how much that Gettysburg Address said to so many people, that kind of work, that the soaring sense that we have an obligation to the present and to the past, to both the living and the dead, to see this experiment through. That's what Lincoln offered at a time, you know, there was no crisis as great in American history as that crisis of the Civil War. So I guess that's my best case scenario. You know, the worst case scenario, a good example of a very bad case is James Buchanan, who famously says in his inaugural address, oh, also slavery, it's not an issue, so let's move on. Like, it's just, Buchanan is just it's comically bad president. I mean, it's tragically bad, too, but Just the failure to confront the situation. I mean, it's not unlike the failure to discuss climate change. Like, let's just pretend it isn't happening. It's not going to have any consequences. I mean, that's sort of what Buchanan had to say about slavery. Like, it's kind of a non-issue. It's a nothing burger, slavery. It's kind of like what Buchanan would have said. And not because he even thought that, but because he couldn't be bothered to fix it.
So when it comes to, as you referred a moment ago, as our current pickle, where does that stand, in your opinion? How does that stand up against, say, a Buchanan?
So I wrote this piece for The New Yorker a couple weeks ago that was really illuminating to me. I pulled out of the library this book that I'd never heard of, but I stumbled across an encyclopedia entry. In 1974, the Watergate Committee asked the Yale historian C. Van Woodward the question whether the stuff that Nixon stood accused of was pretty much just like what any other president has done, and we just didn't know about it before. I guess Republicans on the committee had said, yeah, Nixon's done all this stuff, but probably every president does this, and we just don't know that. So John Dean asked Woodward to pull together a report really quickly on every president, every charge of presidential misconduct. And so Van Woodward got a bunch of historians together, and everyone did a president, and they worked as fast as they could. Everybody gave up their summer vacation, and they submitted the report. But by the time it got submitted, Nixon had resigned. So nobody really wanted to read it. And it was published, but it just disappeared. So no one had even heard of it before. So I went back and I called up all the historians who worked on those reports, who were still living. I think the oldest was 97. The youngest was in his late 70s or 80s. And said, you know, so what... that's really cool. How did that? What was that like? But if you were asked, charged to write such a report now, you know, covering the president since Nixon to Trump, where would we stand? And it was really illuminating. They didn't have a uniformity of opinion, but it was surprising to me how much respect they had for Nixon's leadership on the world stage. You know, the relationship with China, for instance, and Nixon's deep understanding of constitutional matters, his willingness to assert executive privilege and thwart the Constitution is not something to be admired, obviously. But it was striking to me how there was a kind of honorable dishonorableness about Nixon to these guys. It was a little bit like, oh, for the days of Nixon. So that's my indirect answer to your question.
And I assume it's harder for us to nail down a direct answer to the question, isn't there? I mean, the way of asking it, which you allude to toward the end of the book, is just the sustainability of these truths.
Yeah, I mean, the hard thing to look at is not things that Trump has been charged with but hasn't been proven to have done, but things that Trump has done publicly and said publicly, many of them are worse than the things that Nixon was charged. Like, to just defame portions of the population, to defame racial groups, to defame entire religions, these are unconstitutional in the sense of in violation of our notion of the equal protection of the laws, or under sort of like just basic 14th Amendment jurisprudence. They're not unconstitutional acts, but the spirit in which these utterances are made is entirely at odds with the constitutional history of the country. So that is a hard thing to watch. That sort of, yes, we don't know what we don't know yet about what actually was done, and maybe all these allegations just completely unsubstantiated. But that doesn't relieve the historical record of the Twitter archive.
The name of the new book is These Truths, A History of the United States. The book is published by Norton. Jill Lepore, great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, Jill Lepore's new book is These Truths, A History of the United States, published by Norton. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Thanks to Argo Studios and Paul Ruess for their production assistance. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.